Welcome to the Education Committee. I believe that we do have a quorum, so we are going to start.
Thank you.
Senator, we have Senator Johnson. We have Senate File 799. If you are ready to start.
That's a good quorum.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 799, I have a delete all amendment that I would like to offer and have adopted, if you have copies of it.
Thank you.
This was a former, we referred to it as a ratio bill because there were specific numbers in there. Very, very difficult in these financial times to really believe that that could be possible. I think it was is what we hope for in the future at some point in our, hopefully my lifetime. And I would ask that you, I would move that amendment. It's the A13 amendment-0119.
Thank you. Members, any questions on the A13 amendment? If not, Senator Johnson moves the A13 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, we have scaled this bill back significantly and are asking to have a grant program established that would allow school districts to have the option to buy for a grant with a 50% match of the grant if they are interested in hiring some social workers, school counselors, school nurses, any item that they think that they would like to address. So that's the gist of the bill. And we'll have to put in a number in there that we can handle in our budget. Have with me today Dr. Wolf, who will give you some background on why we're asking for this.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you.
Identify yourself. And
thank you.
With
Chair Torres Ray and members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Walter Roberts. I'm a professor of counselor education at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And the language that you have before you today in the amendment is designed to provide opportunities for school districts to create full student services personnel team. And the bill is straightforward just as it reads. And you're going to hear me use this term quite a bit today, the term opportunity, for those school districts who choose to take advantage of it. First and foremost, this is not an unfunded mandate. In fact, it's no mandate at all. No school district would be required to abide by the proposal. It maintains local control. A school district can make a decision whether or not they want to participate in the grant program funding or not. Second, it's an opportunity for school districts to receive grants at a 50-50 level of partnership with the funding source at the state level. Obviously, the goal is to help school districts increase their level of student services personnel teams within the school. The proposal promises to be of particular assistance to school districts where such services are in short supply, such as in our rural areas of the state. Third, it provides the opportunity to increase the effectiveness of our student services personnel teams by reducing their caseloads. Is it a ratio bill? No. Does it recommend following the guidelines of the specific professions when it comes to the number of students recommended to be served by that profession? Yes, it does. Each profession knows what the best caseload maximums are within their profession to provide optimal services to their particular clientele. And we have to be realistic about this in the sense that at some point in time, caseloads just become too big. And that's something that we're facing all across the state with our student services personnel team. Last, Senator Johnson's bill is an effort to provide a model of more equitable funding among the student services professional and create true student services personnel teams. We believe that when school districts have the opportunity to access funding for student services personnel, that they are more likely to take advantage of that opportunity. We are spending a lot of well-deserved time this session talking about serving students when they are identified as in crisis or in trouble, and I would use air quotes around the in trouble piece. I believe that the student services personnel team concept as offered in this grant opportunity, along with the other recommendations that are moving forward in this legislative session, is a way to more effectively reach students, more students, before they get to that particular level of having a problem or having a crisis, by increasing the number of student services personnel available inside our schools. It will increase the likelihood that we can reach more students in the general student body population more effectively and assist them in their chances of academic success to be both mentally and physically healthy before something goes wrong. In many respects, it is another piece to the academic and the safe schools puzzle. I thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I will answer any questions that there may be.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Roberts. Any questions for Dr. Roberts? Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really more of a comment because I've had the opportunity to work with Dr. Roberts in the discussion about the secondary to post-secondary alignment piece. We've looked at, you know, all this wonderful new data that we're going to be getting from the new assessments that we're looking at. It's going to give us the opportunity to work with students at an earlier age and help them be on track. But all that's going to require personnel to interpret that data and advise those students and work with them. And right now, with the level of staffing that we have, what we keep hearing over and over again is that our current student services personnel teams are so stretched that they're constantly crisis management. You know, there's just not the bandwidth to focus on the academic and the career needs that we need them to be able to do. So I think this is a wonderful idea. I think it's so important. And thank you, Senator Johnson and Dr. Roberts, for your work on this.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Johnson, for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate the delete all amendment. I think it's made a lot of improvement to the bill. And I have one question, and that is regarding coordination, especially when we're looking at mental health issues. I'd like to know, what's the coordination between what happens in the school setting and the medical community, where more in-depth services might be needed? And I'm kind of explain that to me, please.
I would ask Dr. Wolf to address that,
yes,
please.
Mr. Roberts. Dr. Roberts.
Thank you. Senator and members of the committee, basically student services personnel inside the school setting do everything possible within their training to help students be academically successful in whatever area that might be. When there is a need to refer out, if students need additional referral, then there are procedures in place inside schools to help move students toward the type of referral services that they need. And I may not be answering your question as specifically as you would like. And I think one reason is because, again, the focus of student services personnel are to help students during the school day, during school activities, be as successful as possible from whatever background that they may be coming from, with whatever needs that they have inside the school setting.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I do appreciate that response, Dr. Roberts. As a former special education teacher, I know about the referral process, and I also know that sometimes there's gaps. Mm-hmm. There are gaps between what happens in school and what's happening in mm-hmm. the medical community. And this might not be the bill to address that, but I think it's something to be cognizant of. So maybe even as the grant process goes forward, having something in the grant process as the RFPs go out or as the requests go out, so that there is that coordination. There must be that coordination. And will these how will the grants be chosen? I mean, who's going to set the criteria for the grants?
Dr. Roberts.
Dr. Roberts.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, it would be the commissioner and the Department of Education who would set the criteria.
Okay. So Madam Chair, that's something that we can certainly discuss with the department, then that's a needed piece to make sure there's good coordination and communication.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I would just
Thank
like
you.
To
Senator
remind everyone that this is available for a grant for, it could be for a you know, an academic counselor person to counsel children about their academic future, or it could be a school nurse or whatever the school decides. So it is certainly, we know of the mental health issues that are really showing up at such a great rate right now that need attention. But this is designed to allow each school to figure out what they need.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Chamberlain and then Senator Clausen.
Just one quick question. I just want to verify, you said this would be 50-50 split. So I think you had said earlier, so the state, if a school district, so they got some money into it, so the school district would have to, say if they have a counselor and it costs $50,000, they'd have to put up $25,000, and the state would be doing $25,000. So this is not just a giveaway to the schools. They still have to make some.
Madam Chair, Senator Chamberlain, they would apply for a grant from the department, and whatever amount of a grant they got, they would have to match that. Whatever amount they got, they would have to match that.
Madam Chair, at least then they have some accountability, and they have to make some decision based on resources. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Senator Clausen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Some questions about Subdivision 3, Item 4. It talks about caseloads among specific team members in excess of 50%. So are you looking at individual, like social worker caseloads, counselor caseloads, so you're looking at each one of those individually?
Senator, Dr. Roberts.
Madam Chair and Senator Clausen, yes, this is within the established recommendations of the individual professions. This is not just about school counseling. This is about school social workers, school nurses, chemical dependency counselors, school psychology and school counseling. So yes, it is about the established recommendations within the profession.
Senator Clausen.
I really believe in the team approach. And I know in a high school guidance counseling office, if you would add a mental health professional, if you would have a chemical dependency counselor, that would greatly reduce the caseload for those counselors who would then be concentrating on other academic needs or other needs of the student. So I'm a little bit confused about four. Exactly how does that situation that I just laid out, a school district has X amount of counselors, they believe that they need to add a chemical dependency person and perhaps a mental health person, that's going to reduce the overall caseload. And do you take that into consideration when you're looking at excess of 50%?
Dr.
Madam Chair and Senator Clausen, you raise a good question, and I think that the intent of the bill clearly is to try to address the issue of caseloads within the entire team. But I think you raise a good question that I don't have an answer for right here on the spot. I think, again, this is one of the priorities of the criteria for a school district in being selected for eligibility to be considered. Again, clearly, I go back to my original testimony, which is, you know, at some point, you know, and we all know, caseloads are just, in many instances, are just too big. I would recommend to the committee I do believe we have a priority that we should look at those school districts that are really understaffed, severely understaffed. And that's one reason why that's one of the criteria there. That's one of four criteria that are there. But you raise a good question that on the spot I don't have a good answer for.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my point is that by including other people, it can adjust that 50%, and it could work in favor of, or it could work against, in applying for a grant. And
Senator
Dr. Roberts,
Madam Chair, and Senator Clausen, I would say at the risk of being reminded of what I say sometime, what I'm about to say is that in some respects this is a free market selection for school districts. They get to choose who they want. They get to choose which set of student services personnel that they believe that they could that they need. And I think that, again, that goes back to local control. I think that the existing student services personnel team inside the school can have conversations among themselves with regard to how they think that. I mean, ultimately, we know this. It's about the kids. It's got to be about the kids. And so I would just stop.
Madam Chair, and if
Senator
I might,
Johnson.
Please. Senator Clausen, you know, we had a meeting a while ago on Senator Dahl's Senate File 1103, Planning for Students' Successful Transition to Post-Secondary Education, et cetera, and I sat at my chair listening, and I wrote alongside of the, in the margin, counselor bill, because with the added emphasis that we are placing on some of these areas, if we want that to happen, we have to have personnel to help with that matter. So then again, it would let those people that have enough counselors for students planning, let them maybe apply for a counselor or a school nurse rather than if they chose to.
Thank you. Senator Dahl, and then do you have a follow-up, Senator Clausen?
I certainly support this, Senator Johnson. I just wanted to clarify that a little bit because, you know, you could have a counseling staff of five, you could have a social worker, you could have a mental health specialist, and you could have a chemical health, and yet that counseling ratio now is really distorted because you're adding three people to the department that will work with people, and so that counseling ratio is going to be really lower. And I just didn't want that to affect necessarily those people applying for the grant, or at least the grant decider should be aware of that.
And Madam Chair and Senator Clausen, I will try to have. I hope this bill will be referred to Education Finance or E-Finance and E-12 Finance, and that we can maybe come back with an answer that's more complete.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I think that would be a good idea because I think that in reviewing in the grant review process, I think that would be an important thing to, to review in order to accomplish what you want to accomplish.
So thank you for the question.
Senator Dahl and then Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe, Senator Johnson, it may be just a technical thing. When I read that same spot in 122, in excess of 50% caseloads among specific members in excess of 50%. Sounds like that they only have a 50% caseload. Should that be 150%? I'm just...
Good question.
I don't.
Thank you, Senator.
No.
Yeah. It says an excess of 50%.
Excess. Mm-hmm. It may be...
Yeah, but that's. I think that's a. As you can hear, Senator Johnson, yeah, this is going to go to finance, but that's an important issue. I think that... you need to clarify in order to make sure that, that you do accomplish what you want. Senator Wicklund.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I just wondered, how long are the grants for? Are they for 1 year at a time? Are they 2 years at a time? I see there's the line 131, school must provide additional funding for a two-year period. Is that the period of the grant is 2 years? Or
that, Madam Chair and Senator Wicklund, yes. That is what this bill is designed to do, a two-year grant.
Okay. And, Madam Chair?
Senator Wicklund.
One other question, Senator Johnson. Is there an opportunity for schools to apply for renewing the grants? Are they single-time? Are they ongoing? Are they? Is there a limitation or not?
Madam Chair, I see no reason that they couldn't apply again. And that would be up to the commissioner then to accept that grant. That's my understanding of what this bill says.
Okay. And Madam Chair.
Senator Wicklund.
Just a comment. I think it's a really good idea that we try to provide additional funding because I think the career aspect, I think we need more people who are able to help address some of that career planning along with all the other, essential needs. One concern about a grant is that after the grant's over, then the staff, continuing to have that staff person, it becomes something that the school district has to think about way in advance because you have this person on your staff that, you'd like to keep, but then may not be able to. Just a comment.
Thank you, Senator. I think that's an important issue, Senator Johnson, because I know what you want to do is really have ongoing support for kids.
Absolutely.
And so we don't want to open the expectation in a district that we have more resources available and that we have this now available to kids, and then in a year they no longer have it. I think that's
Madam Chair,
that's an important issue.
Yes, it is, and you exactly said what is in my mind about this, how important it is, but not to just hear okay for 2 years and then it's gone, but hopefully there would be some means to either get the additional money for it or to find that it is paying for itself. It's well worth it. The people expect that and are willing to help us to get to the point where we maybe at some point would look at ratios.
Senator Torres-Wright.
Dr. Roberts.
It is our hope that this will be such an overwhelming success that it will be the start of something wonderful for both the state and local school district partnerships. So.
Thank you. Senator, I have been advised by the staff that you might want to amend on line 122 to 150, not 50%. Senator Dahl's comment was correct. So if you would like
I would move that amendment on page 1, line 22 to delete the 50 and insert 100. 150.
150. On that amendment, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Clausen.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would encourage the Department of Education, when they do the grant application, that you ask for all current members within the student services team so that we're aware, do they have a chemical dependency person? Do they have a social worker, other people? Because that definitely alters the ratio in the counseling department. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator, I also have an amendment to your amendment that I talked to you about, and I would hope that I can get the support members. This is the A3 amendment. Members, I would like to invite, and Senator Johnson, I would like to invite some testifiers. I would like to explain where this idea came from. I was invited about 3 weeks ago to speak to an amazing group of college students. They are called Students for Education Reform. It was one of the most diverse and wonderful groups I have visited in the last few years. And basically, this group came together to talk about how they could be more connected to the work that we do in the legislature to really help high schools and colleges understand what needs to be done in order to really help students complete their high school, graduate, and then pursue higher education and post-secondary opportunities. And in that conversation, a lot of issues came up. One conversation related to parents and how high schools need to be really more engaging and need to invite parents to be part of that experience of pursuing college experiences. And among these, there was a long conversation about counselors. And I asked the questions to the students about their experiences with counselors because these are students who came from very different backgrounds, economic backgrounds, geographic backgrounds. They were people from, you know, urban, rural communities. And I asked them, what was your experience with counselors? And some of them say, you know, my experience was amazing. I had a counselor that was really versed, that was really helping me. And thanks to that person, I am in college right now, and I know what I'm doing, and it was the right choice. And others said, you know, my counselor didn't even know how I could apply for colleges. They had no idea. They had no idea how to fill out the forms. They were so ill-prepared. And I was very, I just learned a lot from that lesson. And I asked them to continue to work with me and continue to work with this committee and be involved. And they are here to testify, and I would like to invite them to come, because this is some work that we're going to continue to do over the summer, and I wanted to make sure that you know them. They're very interested in working with you in your districts. This group of 59 students that were in this conference that I was invited to came from all over the state. And so I thought it was very important that they are here today. All of you, please come, because you guys were so good. I know that we have I think in the agenda we have two students, Mrs. Gandy and Mr. Evan, who are three students. Please go ahead and identify yourself.
Okay.
Kenneth, I think you should. You have been here. You've been in Senator Weir's committee, but I just wanted to thank you for really including me in these conversations that you're having all over the state about what students need to do in order to pursue education reform. So welcome to the Education Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair Torres, for having us today. My name is, and the committee, my name is Latasha Gandy, and I'm here with Students for Education Reform. We just want to take a few minutes to share our stories as regards to guidance counselors. Do you want to start?
Sure. Greetings, Chair Torres and the committee chairs. My name is Vanessa, and I attended Crosswinds Middle School from seventh grade through 10th grade. This is an IB school, so I was being prepared for college and things like that. And after my 10th grade year, I transferred to Harding Senior High. And through the transition, I was immediately feeling unsupported and lost because they did not take the time to, and I'm not even sure who the person is, that didn't take the time to figure out that I'm supposed to be placed in more IB courses so I can be prepared for college and things like that. So I was immediately just mainstreamed into the school and not realizing at the time that that was a problem. Up until 2 weeks into schooling, I was realizing that word problems is a few steps back. So I spoke with my math teacher, and he let me know that go ahead and push yourself and go and look into those IB classes and things like that. But it ended up falling all on me as a 15-year-old student who really just wants to just get done with school and then maybe go to college one day. I decided to just take a math course in IB. So I failed to be prepared for college, knowing that I wanted to become an educator someday. I was lost and severely under-supported. They had a program called The Power of You that was supposed to help students from St. Paul Public Schools going to Metro State, St. Paul College, and MCTC. I was not one of those students that was able to take advantage of that just because, again, I was under-supported in the whole from the process. Thank you. I had two parents that wanted me to succeed. They just didn't know how to help me do that. And that's basically about it. My experience, I guess, could have been a lot better if there were some more folks or some people who, you know, cared a little bit more about me succeeding. There was something else I wanted to say.
Mrs. Young, could you tell us, could you share with us where are you now and what did you have to do in order to really, you know, make up for all of those things that you were not able to do in high school and what happened as you transitioned into college?
Yes, right now I'm at Metro State and it was my senior year that I started applying to colleges because I knew I wanted to go to college, so I was just applying to random colleges that had a teaching program. I was accepted to maybe three or four of those colleges. I did want to go out of state, but I just didn't know, you know, how do I do that and where do I go and where am I going to get support from? So I decided to just stay close to home, local, and attend Metro State and take it for what it was.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, thank
you. That's very good. Yes.
Now, my story is completely different. My guidance counselor
was... Could you please introduce yourself?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Latasha Gandy with Students for Education Reform. I also attend Metropolitan State. My guidance counselor's story was completely different. She was amazing. She was not only my guidance counselor, she was my social worker. She was my friend. She knew everything about what was going on in my life. So I found it a great experience to have just one central person that could listen to my problems and also tell me how my problems don't make me who I'm gonna be. So she took the time to not just tell me options as far as college, not only to tell me what classes I should take to help ensure that I could have a successful college venture, but she also took the time to talk to me. I think it's really important that when we get confused about having different positions, like you have a chemical dependency person, and then you have a counselor, and then you have a social worker, and then you have this person, when you get all these people involved, you lose connect with the child, with the student. So just having one central person that could address all these issues and ensure that I was college ready was the best thing for me. And I know that a lot of my friends in school wanted that same thing, but they didn't have that quality of a counselor. And when you're assigned a counselor, that's who you get. You know, you don't have an option of, can I switch over? It's your last name is A through M, then you get this person. Your last name is, you know, N through P, then you have this person. You're just stuck with them. And I thank God that I had one that wasn't like that. She made sure and checked in with me in regular intervals that I was doing what I was supposed to do. I didn't immediately go off to college, however, but that had nothing to do with her. That was my life, my choice, and the decisions that I made later on in life. But I did end up going back to college because a college career has always been my dream, to go to college and to successfully complete college. And my counselor, I think the experiences with her made sure that memory stayed in my mind so that I may have lost my way, but I found my way back.
Thank you, Ms. Gandy. We really appreciate that. Please.
My name is Kulia Pringle, and I also attend Metropolitan State University. I'm a year short of becoming a future educator, and I am also a parent of a 17-year-old child who's in the public school system right now. My experience as with guidance counselors, I went to Central High School here in St. Paul, and it was pretty much indifferent. I didn't meet with my guidance counselor until my 10th grade year, and that was to determine, because I had been in foster care in 10th grade, and so I was forced to leave public school and go to an alternative school. And then when I came back to Central, I had to meet with the guidance counselor to figure out how my hours were going to transfer to my credits. And then I didn't meet again with my counselor until senior year, and that was just to decide what was going to happen after graduation. There was no talk of, what are you going to do when you get out of here? What do you want to be? What about college? What about applying for college? I didn't even know that I had a college mind. I didn't find that out until 2 years after I graduated from high school, because I've always loved reading. I always loved history, and I always just like reading just because. And somebody heard me talk and said, you need to be in school. So I feel like I lost a lot of time. Had I known that I had the mind to go to college through that guidance counselor, that I would have been earlier prepared. And also, I do think that there should be support staff in schools, because although I didn't have any meetings with my guidance counselor, I remember specifically Frank Wharton, who I still see today, and he was the youth advocate at that school. He was the one that I would talk to about other things and my personal life, but I did not have a connection with my guidance counselor. My daughter, to this day, has not had any talk to her about what her life is going to be like outside of school. It's as if, to me, it feels like they're waiting on me to fail as a single parent, and they're waiting on her to fail as an urban student. And it doesn't feel like anybody cares whether or not she graduates from high school. She's just going to be another statistic. Like I said, there's no talk. She's a junior right now. I'm the one that's telling her about post-secondary options and things that she can be doing in school, because I was aware of that. But it didn't come from the school. And I feel like there's these policies, but there's a disconnect between when the policies get enacted to them getting implemented in the schools. It's like it's not registering.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening.
Absolutely. So all of you are first generation in college, right?
Yes.
Because a lot of the students that I met were the first generation going to college. So they are learning themselves how to navigate the college experience. And some of them are parents and trying to figure out how to help their kids. So Mr. Evan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Torres-Ray. Thank you, committee. My name is Kenneth Abon. I'm a sophomore at the University of Minnesota, and I'm excited to speak with you today. I'm going to share with you my story of senior year. My senior year was pretty rough. Initially, with like all the college applications I had to fill out, the scholarships, and all the essays, that's enough stress for a college senior to begin with. But I also had to go through some other troubling times. troubling situations. My house was being foreclosed on as a senior in high school, the same house that I had lived in since I was in kindergarten. So that was a pretty big change up in my life. And then also as a result of that, my parents were separating because of some of the strains that caused on their relationship. And it was really hard to deal with. And so also my one getaway in life has been basketball. And so I was playing basketball senior year, but at the time I didn't feel part of the team. And you can say, like, on the surface, like, that's life, that's basketball. But for me, it was almost a therapeutic thing with going through all this pressure and all these difficult situations with my house foreclosing, my parents separating, and then on top of that with dealing with my future, essentially. Basketball was my one getaway, and that not going smoothly for me was also very difficult. And so with all these obstacles in front of me, it was really difficult for me to really focus on my college plan and what I was going to do after high school. For me, it was just about going day to day, dealing with these little new obstacles that keep coming at me. And fortunately for me, though, my counselor knew my whole story. She understood about my parents separating and my parents' relationship. She knew about the house foreclosure because I had a real close relationship with her, and I trusted her with that type of information to tell her about all these things. And she even understood about the whole basketball situation and how basketball was my getaway from some of my harsh realities and how I needed that to be smooth for me to really operate, and that wasn't the case at the time. And so because she knew all this information about me, she was able to help me with my college applications, my scholarships, my planning, and even my application waivers, because she knew that I wasn't able to afford, like, all my college applications because I was going through financial difficulties with my house foreclosing. She knew with my parents separating, I would want to be close to my mom because she was in a completely new situation and she was hurting and I didn't want to go too far away from her. And with basketball, she was just there to, like, be my therapeutic release now that basketball is becoming a difficult time or difficult thing for me. So with all this stuff, she was able to deal with it and be better prepared to help me plan for opportunities after high school and going into college and going to the University of Minnesota eventually. And so I can't even imagine what it is like for a student that's not even told that college is an option for them. Like, I had always knew that I was going to college. It was just hard for me to plan that. But how does someone plan for after high school if they don't even think about that type of thing? Even if it's not college, like career readiness or whatever they want to do after college. So I believe that counselors need to really know their students to be able to plan and trust, for students to be able to trust their counselors and counselors to be able to make an effective plan and strategy for students after high school. So I do ask the committee here to support this amendment to the bill to ensure that our counselors are creating a solid plan for our students as they are going through high school and graduate and enter either an occupation or college.
Thank you so much, Mr. Evan. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have some Metro State on. I'm an alum. Oh, welcome.
Oh. Yay.
Had good chances. Madam Chair, just a clarification. Maybe you mentioned this, but your amendment, affordable, it basically you're talking about career planning and helping through that process. And so you believe that's necessary after the academic, career, and personal help that's in the bill already? Is that, I've been trying to find out the clarification. In the delete all, Senator Johnson has apparently these you could use the money for counselors or whoever to help in academic, career, and personal planning and health need, you know, all those needs.
Yeah.
So how does yours expand? Do we need yours?
So Senator, one of the issues that the students brought to my attention is that we need to be clear on what it means when we say, you know, academic counseling, So we worked together. They came and reviewed a lot of language, and thank you guys for coming to my office and spending a lot of time. We're going to do a lot more work, which has run out of time, but basically what they wanted was to have more specificity in the statute that really says that students should be assisted with high school graduation requirements. A lot of them had to take remedial courses. They were not told that, you know, you just have to take these classes and you have to do whatever it takes. So the whole issue of high school graduation and what it means, the college and career exploration and selection, because many times they're just told, you know, just apply, and they don't know where to apply, whether they can afford to go there. And some of them talk about, you know, they really wanted to go away from home, but they couldn't afford to do that. So a counselor needs to say, you know, this is your choice. Can you afford that? And many of them, you know, were working and paying for their own school. So they were saying, you know, how do we know what we can afford? So their effort is to insert into this statute some more specific language about working with kids and really explaining, you know, what is the process. And they thought that the language here was a good beginning, but this offers a little bit of a specificity. So that's their recommendation, that we be a little bit more specific with counselors in helping students really go through that transition.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, students. I really appreciate that you came. So, Senator Johnson, I don't know if you wish to speak to the A3 amendment, but I think we talk about this. I don't know if you have any remarks related to that.
Chair, and Dr. Wolf said there was one change in the...
Go ahead, Dr. Roberts. Go ahead and say it.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the intent of the bill clearly is to increase the services that we have now. And on line 110 in the delete all amendment, where it says grants must be used to create or maintain student services personnel teams, I think that the actual word rather than maintain should be increase. Because what we don't want to do is let school districts keep their same team at the same level of services and only pay half price. So I think that the language there is rather than or maintain, I think the actual word for, I think, maintain should be deleted and insert the word increase.
Thank you. Senator, that's actually not part of the my language doesn't go there, so we can go into that if you wish after. So mine is towards the end, so that's prior, but, you know, if the members wish. So let's stay on the A3 amendment, and then we will go to that particular.
Okay.
So on the A3 amendment, any more questions? If not, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, if we could go to on line, page 1, line 10, delete, maintain, and insert increase. And I would move that.
Senator Clausen.
Madam Chair, we had earlier talked about that a school district could apply for a second round of this, and in that case, they would be maintaining?
Maybe a third, create, maintain, or increase. Maybe that's a...
Madam Chair and Senator Clausen, you're... I'm 0-2 with you right now. I think that once they get the first 2 years, I think that that's something clearly that would have to be tweaked. Again, the idea of inserting the word increase there is to try to avoid abuse of or unintentional misuse of the grant. Let me say that. So I think the word increase there is a safeguard. And then the next 2 years, when this proves to be so successful that the next 2 years we want to do it again, then we can tweak the language. But thank you for that observation.
So, Senator Johnson, so do we keep it the way it is, or what would be?
We would go ahead with the amendment to change the maintain on line 10, delete that, and insert increase, and then we'll let the commissioner decide. Or we will look at it after a two-year period.
Any questions on that amendment? If not, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. amendment is adopted.
This is yours.
Any closing remarks, Senator Johnson?
No, Madam Chair. I just want to thank everyone for listening, the people who testified. I was pleased. When I saw the names, I didn't know if there were people that were coming forward that were in opposition. So I was very pleased to see that they were here to support the bill and enhance the testimony, I would say.
Thank you, Senator. And I do encourage all of you members to get in touch with the Students for Education Reform Group. They are truly a very diverse group of people that are working in your districts and doing tremendous work to inspire students to pursue college. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful group. So I encourage you to connect with them. So on Senator Johnson's motion to move Senate File 799 and
as amended
and re-refer to
Chair.
Okay, please approach the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director, Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Would just like to share a few comments if
please,
the Chair allows.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I want to thank Senator Johnson for bringing this legislation forward. We agree as the superintendents and district office administrators in the state that we want to make sure that we provide our services to the students, which help best prepare them for their future, for their post-secondary experiences. We'd just like to share a question or two and then make a few suggestions for consideration as the bill continues to move through the process for Senator Johnson to consider. In terms of looking at the establishment of the team, would this mean that in order for a district to apply for a grant, they must have either most of the components in place, and then the grant would allow for the creation of a position that would finalize the team? So is every team defined by having a counselor, a psychologist, a nurse, a social worker, and a chemical dependent person? So are these literally five-person teams? And I'm seeing a head nod. If that be the case, a concern that we would have would be, as we look at 330 some school districts around the state of Minnesota, excuse me, it may not be financially feasible, even with a grant, for some of our greater Minnesota school districts to have these types of resources, even though this is an extremely important area to explore. Challenging times financially, we all know about that. We know that school districts around the state are creating their budgets for the next year. We know that as we read the papers, many districts are looking at reducing budgets, adjusting budgets. And a concern would be, in order to have a maximum number of districts be involved, this would be a constraint. And I didn't say that well, and I apologize. But I think this restricts the number of districts that can apply. Another comment that I would have, and it gets to what some of the conversation was, and I do believe that because of the financial times that we are in, a partnership between the state and a school district would not be a bad one if it did maintain the current level of services, which from my perspective would be superior than to having the districts reduce the services. The districts are reducing services to children now in the area of guidance and counseling, in the area of technology, in the area of the arts, because of financial challenges. And while I applaud the concept that we want to increase services to children, our financial realities as a state representing 330-some school districts is that this type of a program, which would allow a district to partner, receive a grant, provide half of the funding to maintain counselors, would allow the district to use the current funding, half of it, for something else in their general fund which would benefit children, use their half of the dollars, the half of the grant, and they would be able to maintain that person. Whereas without the grant, you may have that position eliminated. I've seen that. I've lived that as a superintendent. I'm watching that happen around the state. And so I would ask Senator to consider, as the bill continues to move forward, is there a way to allow districts to apply for grants that may maintain the level of service, but in doing so may allow those services to continue versus those services being eliminated? And I would ask for consideration that not all school districts in the state are going to be in a position to have a five-person team. It might be a three-person team. It might be a two-person team for smaller schools. But those funds would be as valuable to those people as they would to a system that can afford a five-person team. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Senator Johnson, I think it's clear. I don't know. The issue, I think, that you bring before us is really an enhancement, and it obviously, the intent is that, you know, they will continue. I don't think that your intent is that they will have to eliminate existing in order to be able to be eligible for these new dollars, right?
Madam Chair, it definitely is not my intent that these grants must be used to have put together a five-person team. The grant is available to allow the school district to pick out whatever they feel to be the most important need that they have, and that they would apply for a grant from this. Hopefully there will be money put into this from the department, and it could be one or more. But Mr. Amoroso, I think the committee noted that what we don't want to see is school districts to say, well, okay, I can fund this counselor that we have by getting a grant, or a school nurse by getting a grant from the department, and so just to keep the counselor. We do want it to enhance what they have on hand, but it wouldn't be a five-person team. That is not my intent.
Thank you. Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator. And I appreciate that concept, and I truly wish we were in a position financially as a state that these types of decisions didn't have to be made. But we are in a position where budgets are adjusted, positions are eliminated, and I think it would enhance the possibility to maintain counselors in some districts where they may otherwise be eliminated, with a partnership of 50% from the state, 50% from the district. The district is still making a commitment by funding that 50%. And I apologize if I inferred earlier that you would need to cut something in order to get the funding. What I was trying to share is that districts are making decisions as we speak about what their budgets look like in the future, and they're considering, quite frankly, 80% of our budgets in education are our staffs, our valued staff. And so as decisions are made to reduce or eliminate programming, a grant application, an awarding of a grant, would help a district to maintain or increase, or power to the district they can increase, but potentially maintain a level of services to children while then providing some funding in other areas of their district.
Thank you. Maybe, Senator, what we need to do, you're reminding me of the legacy conversations, that it was not to supplant, but just to add services with the legacy dollars. We might need a word in there that is not to supplant, because it's true that, you know, if they are going to eliminate counselor positions, that's, you know, exactly the opposite of what you want to do. You want to enhance this and you know, grow these up. The dollars to be able to get these needs met. So I think maybe we need to add a couple of words that really specifically clarify that this is not to supplant dollars, but just to continue to build. But that's something that Senator Nelson, Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this discussion about whether we're going to supplement or supplant is something that we have over and over in the legislature. We've talked about it with the legacy funds. And I will tell you, I think it it's caused problems in being so prescriptive. Mm. And at the end of the day, if we want our schools to be able to have more counselors and more student support staff to better meet student needs, then I'm more of a mindset to let's give them the flexibility to do it in the best way that they can. And when we try and overprescribe like this, I think it has some unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So my suggestion would be to not add further language. And, in fact, I voted against the amendment, which talked about taking out the word maintain. I really do trust our local school districts to know what the needs are, to know best how to fulfill those. And if they have budget challenges, this might not help them by being so prescriptive. So at the end of the day, I'm about the result and the outcome, which is making sure students have the services they need. And I think being too prescriptive like this could lead to not fulfilling that mission.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, I wanted to tag on to that. Exactly. Is this an area they're required in this legislation? There's a piece that they have to send a report. So there's accountability. Can we just they apply for the grant, they make the reports later, trust the professionals at the level at the school to use this money in the best way possible, so we get away from this overly prescriptive thing. And I would suggest not having create or maintain or increase, somehow striking that and having some language that gives them the flexibility to use the grants to assist in these mm-hmm. areas. And just they're going to be accountable for this. They got to fill out the grant. They got to do the reports. Let's not tie their hands, because you know, War Road's different than Minneapolis, and I think that at least we can do, at least if I may, Madam Chair, if we can at least one thing out of this committee, give the schools a little flexibility in making a decision, can we do it with this little piece and maybe strike that language and come up with something that gives them that flexibility?
Thank you, Senator. And it's true that we have in Subdivision 5, Senator, you have reports. So this is something that you definitely, you know, the public and we can track and find out, you know, how it's going, because there is a request for a report. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, and, you know, I can agree with almost everything that's been said from the members here. And I would ask if you would be willing to, since we're all on the E-12 committee, if this goes and gets into the bill, that there will be, we will talk with you and I think you have some very good suggestions, both you, Senator Nelson, and Senator Chamberlain. So if you would, in the interest of time and the interest of seeing, it's not, it's an important thing, but it is not devastating either way.
Thank you, Senator. And I think that, you know, I'm not advocating for more prescriptive language. I just thought, you know, to meet some of those. But I think that the reports are fine, and I think that you can work on this, and just the department should be able to alert, you know, the legislature if we run into situations where there is a lot of use of this money and they are not mm-hmm. really complying with the spirit of what you're trying to do. Okay, on Senator Johnson's motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion is adopted. Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Sorry. Victoria, a simple bill.
Shouldn't be like, we'll work on it later.
Senator Torres Ray with Senate File 269. Feel free to begin whenever.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I my intent was to move Senate File. This is the House 269 today, but it is my understanding that we need more dialogue and that some of these changes that we want to make are not that simple, and we have multiple coalitions who are very interested in participating, which is good. But the challenge is to move forward with a bill that actually addresses all of those concerns and bring all of these coalitions together. But I had done extensive work in this area, members, and obviously not like Ms. Abderholden by any means. And she spent a number of hours to bring us to a place where, you know, we really have a lot of consensus. And I invited her to present today. Unfortunately, it seems that we're not ready, but I do wanted to give her an opportunity to walk us through this bill, because I do believe that this is a very important issue that we need to talk about. And so with your indulgence, I would like to ask her to walk through the bill just to help us learn about some of the very critical elements that we need to address in order to provide education in treatment settings. And so with that, I'm going to pass it on to her.
Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee once again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to give you a little background on this issue. So when you have a school-aged child that has a serious mental illness and is in need of intensive mental health treatment and services, the challenge becomes treating the child's mental health needs while still tending to his or her educational needs. And without the synergy of mental health services and educational services, a child is left with either an untreated mental illness, a missed education, or both. And such situations not only affect the trajectory of that child's life, but they also affect the child's family and community. The education system and the children's mental health system are structured very differently, and each system serves different purposes, and each has its own set of policies and procedures. And for school-aged children with mental illnesses, these two systems have to have the capacity to work together. I would say that there's a lot of misunderstanding about how the two systems are supposed to work together. They come from different frames of mind. There's not a lot of clarity from either departments, and so you know, a lot of it is left up in the air. I'll just remind you that kids with a mental illness have probably the worst outcomes in terms of dropping out of school, of course, ending up in the juvenile justice system. So what we were trying to do in this bill is a couple of things. One was address year-round education. In a care and treatment setting, you need year-round education for a number of reasons. One is to make sure you have effective therapeutic outcomes. But for children who are in them, they kind of have two parallel universes. What happens, of course, in the treatment setting affects what happens in the academic setting and vice versa. The school calendar has these extended breaks built into it, particularly over the summer, and yet kids are in care and treatment settings for, you know, the 12 months. And so we don't have that connection there, which can make it, you know, certainly a problem. And so what we looked at was we couldn't do the year-round education, but at least a flexible school calendar so that you wouldn't have, you know, 2 months off totally with education. The other thing to remember, of course, as well, is that these children are not being educated for the same number of hours per day because they're in a care and treatment setting and they're getting their treatment needs taken care of as well. The care and treatment placement decisions was also a problem that we tried to address in this bill. When a child needs intensive treatment, there are a lot of people deciding, you know, what that treatment should be. And these parties are also involved in deciding where it will be. You could have the parents and guardians. You could have clinical mental health professionals. You have the resident districts. You have the placing districts. You have the courts, the county human services. You have health plans and others. So you can imagine how much conflict there can be. And what we didn't have was a clear understanding of who actually got to make those decisions. And so sometimes there were disagreements about, well, no, they shouldn't go to that day treatment center. They should go to the one that's in our district, when that might not have met the clinical needs of that child. And so we were trying to separate that out as well. Transportation, unfortunately, because of the cost, plays a huge role in where a child will go as well. And you can understand the districts not wanting to transport children, you know, across county lines into another setting. We also set up the reimbursement system for parents so that they didn't get a real round trip, because you don't drive your child there and then stay with them for the day. You drive them there and then you go to work or, you know, go home and take care of your other kids. But we would only pay for one round trip. And not, frankly, two, kind of what in the transportation system they call unload, you know, non-load miles, which also then puts the burden, if the family doesn't have a lot of money, puts the burden back on the school district to provide that transportation. Another issue we had is defining day treatment.
We have a problem in that the statute mentions the term day treatment and day program, but it really doesn't explicitly define that. What we found is that there really was, in some ways, a loophole. We have, through the Department of Human Services, day treatment, which we define as more clinical mental health treatment. But sometimes in the school settings, we would actually see that they would call their level 4 EBD programs as day treatment. Even some corrections programs did that. So then you have a family thinking their child is getting day treatment of a clinical nature when it really is just an education setting. And that, of course, would create problems both for the child and the family as well. We do have children in these care and treatment settings who do not have an IEP, and that creates a whole other problem in terms of how do you meet their needs if you have, you know, a special ed teacher who is teaching to everyone and there's two kids without an IEP. You technically have to bring in another teacher then to do that, and just kind of a mess, frankly, in terms of trying to figure out how to meet their needs. Another issue is the collaboration that needs to happen between the care and treatment programs and the schools. Some day treatment or residential programs will say that the districts are putting teachers in there to teach those kids who really are not equipped to teach them. It does take, you know, I think, additional training, a real interest in and liking to work with children who have these serious mental illnesses, patients, you know, all sorts of things that goes along with it, and not feeling like there was a collaboration between it so that you really had the teachers who were best equipped to teach those kids. On the other hand, when you had an educational program in a care and treatment program, then you got problems with the school district saying, well, who's overseeing it, who's ensuring FAPE, you know, who's doing all of those kinds of things, and so you really run into this, frankly, big problems between those two systems. And some treatment programs really try to have a very integrated treatment program. So they're not saying, well, for these 3 hours you're going to be educated and then these 3 hours you're going to be in treatment. They really try to integrate it throughout the day, which makes it difficult then for a district to come in and provide that educational services as well. So these are some pretty big issues to tackle. I will say that we've been working on this since 2009. Granted, we took one summer off when I had some deaths in my family, but we've had over 30 representatives from the mental health side, from schools, from everybody, transportation experts at the table trying to figure out, so how do we really make these two systems work effectively, both for the kids and for their families. And so what we have in this bill, which we thought we were getting so much closer to, and I will joke that then the lawyers got involved and looked at the nitty-gritty words and then, you know, were worried about it. But we tried to take all of the care and treatment language from all over the education statutes and put it into one section, because right now it isn't, which makes life, frankly, even more confusing. So we tried to do that. We tried to clearly define and streamline the roles of education, day treatment, and residential treatment services. We tried to discourage fighting between the resident and providing district by just saying we're going to create a funding source for the education that's provided to these children so they're not going back and forth and all the billing stuff that I'm sure you've all heard about. So it would just be a single source of funding both for the education and for the transportation. Creating the flexible school calendar. Creating a path to a state-certified education program. So if you had a day or residential program that wanted to have a more kind of integrated approach and really kind of teachers who are highly trained in working with these children, they could actually get certified by the state, and then the districts wouldn't have to worry about who's overseeing it in terms of FAPE. Creating an MOU for greater collaboration between both the school district and the residential treatment provider so that they're on the same page and working together a little bit more clearly and closely. And then we wanted to rename day treatment so that we would change actually the mental health statute so it would be a mental health day treatment program. And so you can't call it anything else but that unless you meet those clinical standards, which would help families know what their child is actually getting, because it's very confusing. If you have a child with a serious mental illness, you are in a whole other world and trying to figure out all this stuff and thinking that it's something different. We just need to be really clear so that they can do that. And then we would also reimburse parents for travel costs for those non-load miles so that we could encourage them to do it, which creates less of a nightmare for districts trying to do that. Again, the devil has been in the details. I feel like we've gotten very, very close this year, closer than we ever have before. There really was agreement on the concepts in terms of moving forward. The devil has just been in the details, and so as you all know, sometimes people don't worry about the details till you get a hearing, and then all of a sudden they worry. And so I think that's a little bit what happened here, but I think that's fine. What we really want to do, though, is what we wanted you to understand the problems that are out there, kind of the solutions we're trying to bring to the table, and hopefully next year, you know, we can come back. I will say that not knowing what you were going to do with the special ed funding formula also played a role in saying, well, how can we move forward with this until we know what you're going to do with that? So I'm really hopeful that next year we'll be able to come back with all the details, nitty-gritty ones worked out, and really be able to solve this longstanding issue between our care and treatment programs and the schools. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Are there any questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Thank you for that discussion and information. And it reminds me of that concern I mentioned in our last bill, which was about this coordination of care. And I so worry that, especially in things like mental illness, where we need to have very very much coordinated care, and I'm kind of worried at times that we have these separate systems that you described in many details, but I think it just gets down to the kid, and we're not doing what's best for the student because we have these different silos of how we deal with students, and that really concerns me, and I'm hoping that as you move forward with this, that we should be able to figure out how to handle these siloed differences, whether they be turf issues or funding issues or accountability issues. We should be able to figure out how to do that. And we ought to put the needs of the student first and work backwards from that. So I wish you well as you continue forward in this.
Thank you.
And I know there's a few other testifiers, I believe, and I know at least one has come to my attention, but did you want to hear from them at this time? Senator?
Yes,
okay.
Senator.
And again, as we listen to the testimony, I mean, obviously the bill is still a work in progress, and it sounds like an open-door policy to make sure that we get this right going forward. So, Jan Ramosa? Please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Jan Armasa, and I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Association for Directors of Special Education. I want to thank Senator Torres-Ray and for her work in this bill because I think it's extremely complex. And as Sue has outlined for you, I would like to commend Sue and her leadership for bringing all of us together. I know MACE has been involved in sitting at the table with all of the different stakeholders who are invested in trying to figure out how to create this coordination and collaboration with the school districts. Today, what I would like to just share with you is a little bit about the MACE perspective that Sue also brought to your attention in terms of the trying to work on the collaboration. We are very concerned about a fragmented system of delivery of services to our students and to our families. And so the purpose of us trying to integrate all of the languages of all these bills, I think, is absolutely critical. And so that we spend the time to get that language so that it does correctly define the pieces that we need to define. The directors of special education, as you know, are charged with the responsibility in delivering a free and appropriate public education for the students with disabilities. In addition, they are also charged for providing the services for students who are regular education students who may be attending the care and treatment facilities. So we feel that it is incumbent to have a process that we can trust with the Commissioner of Education in an approval process that will be looking at and overseeing the compliance regulations and responsibilities with respect to care and treatment. And in some of the cases, as Sue alluded to, in integrated daycare, we do not see that kind of supervision in the private arena. So we are concerned about that. So that dilemma exists for us in terms of being able to be engaged in that. I would just like to share with you a little bit. I served as the director in the Hopkins Public Schools, and the Hopkins Public Schools had lots of different models. We had the Hennepin County Homeschool, which served the adjudicated youth. And as a result, we were held responsible as the serving district for providing the education for regular and special education students. One of the ways that we dealt with the licensure issue was to have teachers be licensed in a content area as well as being licensed as a special educator so that they would have the capacity to serve students in both of those arenas. We also worked very extensively with Hennepin County to negotiate a contract so that we would be able to work together in terms of how those services would be provided, even though most of those students were Minneapolis students, and originally Minneapolis had been the serving district to provide those services, and then Hopkins became the serving district when Hennepin County was asking Hopkins to step up and provide the rigor to the curriculum that they felt they needed. Hopkins also had a residential treatment center called Omegon that was approved by the Commissioner of Human Services, and therefore there was a negotiated contract between Hopkins and the Department of Human Services and the county to be able to provide the supervision and services through care and treatment as well with MDE oversight that was very critical in that arena as well. We also had a private daycare that was by storefront agency, which had the capacity to request who would provide those services, and we were what is called the serving district to be able to provide that kind of treatment. I'm trying to share that with you as ways to show that there are totally different kinds of models between private and public that have to be established in terms of how does that contract work and how do we create those. So MACE is in support of some kind of memorandum of understanding that would create an agreement between the providing school district as well as the agency, the treatment agency, under the definitions that would be clarified in this bill. We feel that in the same vein, that it's very important that there be clarification in terms of the cost containment and what happens with the issues around special transportation. We have had some families request that transportation be provided for students for whom we are responsible for providing the education that may be in Montana or Utah where their care and treatment facility has occurred. And so that presents a huge concern. Therefore, MACE is in support of the Education Services Fund that would look at the provision of services and payment for those services between the state and the local school district to be able to meet the needs of the students for whom we think we need to provide services. We continue to support the continuation of the conversations that need to go on to address some of the issues about resident district versus providing district in creating an individual IEP, in looking at issues about the emergency services as if there needs to be implemented with the restrictive procedures. And we also think that it's important to see that all of that is in alignment with what's going to happen again with the special education funding formula and how that's going to be determined. We thank Sue Abderholden again for pulling us all together in the future here in terms of building that understanding and consensus amongst all of us. And we strongly commend Senator Torres for really tackling this very complex system, and we thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Hermosa. Any questions? Thank you. Mary Regan, is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. We're a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. And I represent some of the care and treatment facilities that we're talking about today, day treatment programs, residential treatment programs across the state. I also want to thank Sue Abderholden, who has done a masterful job of bringing diverse folks together for the last 3 years. And I got quite sad listening to her describe all the wonderful things that are in this bill and the fact that we're not, in fact, here today to try to get it passed. I also agree with Ms. Hermosa that a lot of the issues are about different systems, but there's a lot of variability around the state. there are one set of laws and rules, but how those are interpreted can vary by district. And often the particular education program that's available to children in a particular care and treatment setting is based upon the relationship and the will and the interest and ability of the local district where that facility is located to provide the education services that those children need. And this has changed quite a bit over the years. Prior to being in this position, I ran a residential treatment center in Minneapolis. And while that was many years ago, I saw a shift over the time that I was there in the amount of education that was offered, and have certainly seen a shift in the last 15 years in this position of districts' willingness to provide summer school, for example. As Ms. Abderholden mentioned, children and adolescents who get referred and admitted into these pretty intensive mental health programs can come in at any time of the school year. Some might be admitted in May, and they may have been in and out of the hospital for the 3 months prior to that admission, so have not been able to benefit from education. It does them no good if they finally get into treatment and suddenly they have another 3 months before there's any further education. These kids are often very far behind, even if they're not on an IEP, and they really need consistent, intensive treatment as well as education services, and that's what is provided in these settings. But it really is about the collaboration between the education staff and the treatment staff. In some models where there is very good collaboration, they are really partners. The treatment staff are often in the classroom to provide support for individual children or for the teacher. The educators participate in the staff meetings and the discussions about children and their overall needs. And then in other parts of the state, that doesn't happen at all. It's very separate. There's not the communication or the collaboration that's needed. This bill really allowed some of the things, the memorandum of understanding, the opportunity for MDE to set some of those boundaries and direction for programs, and then the transportation problem with the funding. All of those things were resolved in this bill, so I really do hope that we can work with the lawyers, I guess, and figure out where the concerns are and make this happen soon. So thank you very much. And thank you to Senator Torres-Ray for carrying the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Reagan. Is there any questions for the testifier? Thank you. There's one more testifier in the audience. If Sir Rick Helley in the audience wanted to make some brief remarks. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members of the Education Senate Committee. My name is Richard Heller. I'm here at the Capitol to unofficially represent the print-disabled and twice-exceptional learners. If it helps anyone out to understand the language, currently it's in the Governor's Bill or Senate Bill 798 on page 11 and 12. One of the reasons I like to speak on this bill because EDB, emotional behavior disorder, is likely related to this, I think, and I believe Minnesota Department of Education is currently targeting one of those four groups. You'll find that study done at St. Thomas as they bring this language forward. One of the experience I had with a chemical dependency program in one of the largest school districts in the state of Minnesota is an individual learner that I knew that had an individual education plan. When they went to the facility, chemical treatment center, they had an alternate learning center. They shared 50% of the time with the school district, so meaning the student academically spent 50% of his time under alternate learning center, and then the other 50% they would spend at the chemical dependency center, or also terms, as you can see in this bill, other terms they use. So what I found interesting is that, first of all, They did not allow for assistive technology devices at all in the facility. And if we're all about 21st century skills and using widgets and accessibility and about universal design for learning, which is found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act, where also you'll find print disabled and blind only. What I find disturbing is when I approached the individuals based on the kids' individual IEP, they said, we have no choice. We have our rules, and we will not allow technology devices in our facility. I think it's important that if alternate learning centers and chemical dependency centers being private and frankly almost impossible to penetrate as a parent because of mental health, raise a higher bar about accessibility for your own child, that if they're going to somehow use any kind of monies and have shared responsibilities at, you know, as integration systems as we try to improve them in our state, that they need to be compliant, perhaps like state agencies are. As you know, Minnesota passed a statute in 2009, Statute 16, about web accessibility 2.0 and 508. However, it's my understanding currently that school districts are exempt from that. I have a letter specifically from a school district telling me that they are exempt from that rule, even though they may use monies from state coffers. What I find is what not good for the goose is good for the gander. I think if we can't get full accessibility, we can't have equal opportunity regarding outcomes. The details, is in order to know the details, you have to have full accessibility for engagement, participation, engagement, and ownership. I'd ask that perhaps a meaningful discussion could happen with the appropriate groups, if I could be part of that. And I'm open to any further questions. Thank you for this time.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Appreciate your testimony, taking the time today. Are any questions for Mr. Heller? Or thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the opportunity. Just so you know that both Ms. Regan and Ms. Afterholden are my constituents, so I am privileged to have people who are incredibly knowledgeable, and I know that I'm going to be doing more work with them during the interim, and I look forward to do that and hopefully bring you next year a proposal that, you know, we can move forward. So thank you for listening. Thank you for this opportunity to present this, and we will continue to work on it.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, and I believe that's all the business we have today.
It is.
Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, members.